Thank you, Joe, and good afternoon, everybody. It's a real pleasure for me to be able to be here today to support the work of the Australian Bureau of Statistics by participating in today's NatStats conference. The conference itself is evidence of the ABS's commitment to high-quality statistics. It's also evidence of the Bureau's commitment to making sure that its statistics remain relevant as the economy evolves over the years ahead. Today, I would like to talk a bit about that expected evolution and some of the issues that it raises. My central thesis really has two elements. The first is that the medium-term prospects for the Australian economy look to be more positive than they did some years back. This is partly the result of policy choices that have been made within Australia, but it also reflects the development in the economies of Asia. The second element is that as Australia's medium-term prospects have improved, the risks facing the economy have also changed, and these risks need to be carefully managed. So in my time today, I'd like to explore both of these elements. I think now, as is pretty well understood, Australia has come through the global downturn in very good shape. Not only is the business cycle here being muted relative to elsewhere around the world, but our medium-term prospects look to be brighter than those of most other advanced economies, and they also look brighter than they were a decade ago. For many years, it seemed like Australia was inexorably slipping down the global league tables. The prices of our exports were falling relative to the prices of our imports, and there was little optimism that this would change. It was only a decade ago that Australia was viewed as an old-fashioned, low-tech economy relying on natural resources instead of developing new technologies. Well, today things look quite different. While there are continuing uncertainties about the near-term outlook for the global economy, there is more optimism now about the medium-term prospects than there has been for some time. The prices of our exports have risen substantially, investment in Australia is high, and Australian assets are once again viewed as attractive by international investors. Now, I've talked on previous occasions about the factors that have helped Australia through the global downturn. I don't want to revisit those today. Rather, I want to focus on why this change in perceptions has occurred, and in particular, the role that the development of Asia has played. I think at a general level, the Australian community understands the importance of Asia to Australia. Despite this, it's the news from the United States and Europe that dominates our newspapers and our airwaves, and with this constant flow of information from the North Atlantic, it is sometimes easy to forget how profound and how important to Australia are the structural changes that are taking place in Asia. And two of these changes are particularly important. They're the twin processes of urbanisation and industrialisation. As the countries of Asia have urbanised and industrialised, the demand for infrastructure there has grown very rapidly. When people move to the cities, new dwellings need to be built, and when incomes rise, so too does the quality of dwellings that people expect. And the growth of these urban centres has also required the building of communication and transportation networks, and the demand for roads, railways, bridges, etc. has been rising strongly. Now, all this development requires raw materials. In particular, it requires steel to build the apartments in which the new city dwellers live and to build the infrastructure that supports these cities. For example, a typical 90 square metre apartment in China requires about 6 tonnes of steel, and to build 10 kilometres of metropolitan subway requires around 75,000 tonnes. And on average, every tonne of steel that's produced requires about 1.7 tonnes of iron ore and over half a tonne of coking coal. Australia's in the fortunate position of having ample, low-cost, high-quality supplies of both of these commodities. And with higher energy consumption also a feature of industrialisation, we're in the fortunate position of having large reserves of energy in the form of natural gas. And not surprisingly, the strong growth in demand for these raw materials in Asia has led to very large increases in the price of raw materials over the past decade. And as you can see from my first graph here, the terms of trade have increased very significantly, and they're now at their highest level since the spike in the early 1950s when wool prices soared due to the Korean War. These higher prices have raised the return on capital in Australia, particularly in the resources sector, and the result has been a very large increase in investment. Indeed, Australia has become one of the high investment countries of the developed world. And as you can see from this next chart, the stock of physical capital in Australia over recent years has been increasing at around 5%, which is an historically high rate. By way of contrast, in most other advanced economies, including the United States, the level of investment over recent years has barely been enough to offset the depreciation of the existing capital stock. Over recent years, when people have talked about the impact of Asia on Australia, the focus has rightly been on China. The transformation that is going on there is truly remarkable, and it's reshaping the global economy. As you can see from this chart, the proportion of the Chinese population living in urban centres has more than doubled in the past three decades to almost 45%. While there have been a couple of other historical examples in which countries have urbanised as quickly as China has, the sheer number of people migrating to urban centres is unprecedented in human history. Over the past 30 years, nearly 400 million Chinese citizens, that's almost 20 times the current population of Australia, have moved to the cities. As a result, there are now around 170 Chinese cities with more than a million residents. In Europe, the equivalent number is just 35. Now, this process of urbanisation in China has still a long way to run. Most estimates suggest that in the next 20 to 30 years, another 300 to 400 million people will move from the country to the city. Now, these developments in China are obviously being closely observed in Australia, including at the Reserve Bank. A decade or so ago, we spent a lot of time puzzling over why the quarterly movements in Australian GDP and US GDP were so highly correlated. We don't puzzle over this anymore, not because we ever really solved the puzzle, but because the correlation has fallen, as you can see in this chart. At the same time, the correlation between quarterly movements in Australian and Chinese GDP has steadily increased over the past decade. So clearly what happens in Australia today is now more dependent upon what happens in China than it has been in any time in our past. But as we think about the future, the story is broader than China. Over the years ahead, the Indian economy, which also contains more than 20% of the world's population within its borders, is also likely to become increasingly important to Australia. After India grew at a disappointing pace in the 1960s and the 1970s, growth there has picked up over recent decades, and in the last decade it averaged just over 7%. The Indian economy has gradually opened up to foreign trade and foreign capital, and government influence over investment decisions has declined. And while India will inevitably follow a different development path to that of China, the prospects of sustained, solid growth in India over the years ahead look to be better than they have for many years. And like China, India too is urbanising. The process, though, there is considerably more gradual, with the number of people moving from the country to the city over the last 30 years, less than half of that in China. Reflecting this, despite the fact that India's population is only marginally lower than China's at the moment, India only has 40 cities with over a million residents compared to China's 170 or so. And the fact that the urbanisation rate is lower there reflects the fact that India has not industrialised as quickly as China. As I mentioned a few moments ago, as people move to the cities, the demand for steel rises strongly. And not surprisingly, in China, consumption of steel has quadrupled since 1997. And just over half the current consumption of steel in China is used in the construction sector. In India, Steel consumption has also grown a little, but obviously not at the same scale as in China. However, if you look at the experience of China and that of other countries that have industrialised, it hints at the potential growth in India. While at the moment the bulk of the Indian population live in rural areas and investment in infrastructure is low, there is the potential for this to change over the years ahead, just as it has in China over the past 30 years. If this does indeed occur, then the demand for raw materials, and steel in particular, is likely to grow very strongly over the years ahead. Now, this impact of Chinese and Indian development isn't just confined to the resources sector. As countries develop and living standards rise, not only does the demand for steel increase, but so too does the demand for high-quality food, and you see consumption of protein rising as income levels rise, and you can see that in this chart, which plots income per head and protein consumption per head. I think, again, the comparison of China and India is instructive. As income per head in China has grown over the past 30 years, protein consumption per head has also risen very strongly, almost doubling. In India, protein consumption per head has also risen a little, though the increases have been obviously much smaller than in China, partly due to slower growth in income per head and differences in dietary preferences. But again, over the years ahead, it's likely that the global demand for protein will grow very strongly, particularly if India and China continue on their current paths. And with Australia's strong history of agricultural production, this is another area where we have a natural advantage. The overall impact of this growth and urbanisation in Asia can be clearly seen in international trade statistics. As you can see from this chart, the four largest markets for our exports are now China, Japan, India and South Korea. Over the first half of 2010, around 22% of Australia's export receipts have come from exports to China, and a further 8% have come from exports to India. These shares have been trending higher for some years now. I think it's likely that that trend will continue over the medium term. As you can also see from this next chart, there's been a very large increase in the share of resources in Australia's total exports. A decade ago, iron ore and coal together accounted for only around 10% of our total export revenue. In contrast to that, over the past 6 months, iron ore and coal together have accounted for around one-third of our total export receipts. With total resource exports accounting for 55% of aggregate exports, up from around 35% in the 1990s. Now, these changes in the country and product composition of our exports are very large. They are also likely to be persistent, given that development in Asia still has some years to run. I think this development means that in aggregate, the Australian economy has the potential to do very well over the years ahead. Conditions, though, are likely to differ substantially between sectors of the economy. If past experience is any guide, the growth of the resources sector will have positive spin-offs for a number of industries, and the rising real incomes that we're experiencing will increase demand for a wide range of goods and services. Other industries, though, will find conditions more difficult due to both the level of the exchange rate and competition for labour and for capital. While these differences across sectors will create some challenges, the overall medium-term outlook for the Australian economy is quite a positive one. And I'd like to turn to the second element of my thesis, and that is just as the medium-term outlook has changed, so too have the risks, and these risks need to be carefully managed. Now, one obvious way that the risks have changed, as I said before, is the economy is now more dependent upon the Chinese economy than it has been in the past, and I suspect we'll be saying the same thing about the Indian economy within a few years. While this is generally a good news story, both India and China do face significant challenges over the years ahead. In China, the authorities face the difficult task of transitioning from a growth model based on exports and investment to one based on domestic consumption. And in India, the burden of red tape remains very real, and ways need to be found to improve the country's infrastructure if the economy's potential is to be unlocked. I think it would be unrealistic to assume that the growth paths in these countries will be without bumps, perhaps large ones. And these bumps will inevitably have an impact upon Australia. Nor can we assume that commodity prices will remain at their current elevated levels. New sources of supply are being discovered and developed, and there's always the possibility of new technologies reducing the demand for Australia's main resource exports. There's little that we can do about these external risks, but what we can do is to have the right policy framework in place so that we can respond when things turn out differently to what we expect. And there are four aspects of risk management that I'd just briefly like to touch on. The first is ensuring that productivity growth is strong. The second is ensuring that the economy retains its flexibility. The third is the way that the high level of investment is financed. And the fourth is the rate at which national consumption adjusts to the improved medium-term outlook for the economy. So first to productivity growth. Regardless of how things develop in the countries to our north, increasing productivity must remain the key to sustained increases in our living standards. Ensuring that we continue to make progress here provides insurance against the possibility that things in Asia do not turn out as positively as we expect. Now, if we look back over recent years, we see that productivity growth has slowed down. You can see that in the orange line there. Since 2001, output per hour worked has increased at just over 1% per year, compared with an average increase of just over 2% per year in the 1990s. And this slowdown in productivity growth has occurred despite a significant rise in Australia's overall capital labour ratio, which would typically be expected to boost average output per hour worked. And normally, slower rates of productivity growth would lead to slower increases in average living standards. But over the past decade, this has not occurred. Indeed, over the last 10 years, growth in gross national income per hour worked has been unusually strong, as you can see in the chart, averaging 2.75% per year. And the reason for this is that the price of Australia's exports have risen relative to the price of our imports, lifting the purchasing power of Australia's national income. In effect, with the proceeds of a tonne of iron ore, we can now buy more LCD TVs and more domestic services than we could a decade ago. And this has allowed us to increase our living standards at a faster pace than if we had to rely on productivity growth alone. If we look forward, I think it would be unrealistic to expect that this situation could continue. Over the next few years, commodity prices are likely to decline somewhat from their current high levels, and this will put the focus back onto productivity growth and economic reform as the key drivers of increasing living standards. The second issue that I wanted to touch on is the importance of ensuring the economy remains flexible and can respond to unexpected developments. My colleagues at the Reserve Bank and I have spoken at length on previous occasions about the key elements here. Having a flexible exchange rate has been one of the great stabilising forces in the Australian economy over the past 30 years. Labour market flexibility has also been important. So too is retaining the flexibility of both monetary and fiscal policy to respond quickly if things turn out differently to what we expect. And to this list, I would add the importance of having a highly trained and educated workforce, because not only does education help lift productivity, but it also makes the economy more flexible, and this helps lower the risk in the economy. The third element that affects the nature of the risks is the way that investment is financed. Historically, much of the external funding for business investment has come from banks. And while bank financing is likely to remain important for many firms, a greater share of investment is likely to be financed from other sources than has been the case in the recent past. Now, this may not be particularly welcome news to the banks, but having investment financed from a variety of different sources does help reduce aggregate risk. Over the years ahead, foreign direct investment and capital market raisings by the resource sector firms are both likely to play a more important role than they have over the past decade. And this means that some of the risks, and of course some of the expected returns from the rapid increase in Australia's capital stock, will be shared with foreign investors. The fourth element of risk management that I'd like to talk about is the response of domestic consumption to the improved outlook. The textbook says that if future income prospects improve, the level of national income, whether that be private or public, should increase now. But the textbook also says that the lower our appetite for risk, or the greater the degree of uncertainty about the future, the smaller should be any immediate adjustment in consumption. It also says the more uncomfortable we are about the possibility of a future decline in spending if things do not work out well, the smaller should be the adjustment we make now. And if we look back at our own economic history, we see in the early 1980s what can happen if the adjustment in spending is too quick. In the first couple of years of that decade, there was a lot of optimism about the future of the resources sector, largely reflecting the rise in oil prices after OPEC 2. This optimism was quickly translated into higher wages and increased spending, and the economy grew very quickly for a while. But the optimism turned out to be short-lived, and the result was a significant hangover, which required a substantial adjustment in spending and real wages in the following years. By way of contrast, the current experience looks quite different. Despite the high optimism about the future, household spending has been relatively restrained over the past couple of years, and the appetite for debt has declined. And as a result of that, you can see that growth in household borrowing has slowed very significantly from the average of the past two decades. Now, one interpretation of this is that the household sector, after having increased its debt levels for many years, and witness the problems elsewhere in the world, now has a better appreciation of the risks. If this interpretation is correct, it's likely to be a good thing from a risk management perspective. And I say this for two reasons. First, restraint now provides some insurance against the possibility that things do not work out as well as expected. In doing so, it can help lower the probability the costly adjustments will be required at some point in the future. Second, given there's currently a relatively limited amount of spare capacity in the economy, the risks of upward pressure on inflation would be increased if both investment and consumption were to increase very strongly over the next few years. In summary, then, while we can do little to control the external environment that Australia faces, the choices that we make on productivity, on flexibility, on financing investment, and on national consumption will influence the overall risk profile of the Australian economy. So while we look forward with considerable optimism to the future, we also need to be alert to the risks and how we might best manage those risks. I'd like to just close with a couple of observations on what this all means for the collection of statistics. First, we need high quality and comprehensive statistics if we are to understand the structural changes that are taking place in the economy. One obvious area where the demand for statistics is increasing is in the resources sector. We need to understand where the investment is going and how both production volumes and prices are changing. But we also need to understand how the developments in the resources sector are affecting other parts of the economy. What are the linkages, and how are those linkages changing? Secondly, the ABS's work is also important in helping us understand some of the risk management issues that I spoke about. We need to continue making progress on the measurement of productivity and improving our understanding of what drives increases in output per head. And on the financial side, we need to understand how the increase in Australia's capital stock is being financed and how changes in the pattern of financing are altering the economy's overall risk profiles. And I know these are areas the ABS is working on, and I look forward to seeing the outcome of that work in due course. Thank you very much for listening.
I might start, though, by throwing open this question of international standards. It seems that Australia does perform very well as far as the gathering of statistical data is concerned, that we have a role to play internationally. But how serious is it, the fact that there isn't a global standard and that there are so many large economies that do not have the sort of data that is required at the level of quality that we require? Dr. Lowe, would you like to get the ball rolling on that issue?
Well, you've identified quite an important issue. And for us, it's the focus is really on China, obviously. And the Chinese authorities have been making progress, but there's still a lot of progress that still needs to be made. And one result of the fact that the statistics aren't as comprehensive as in some other countries is we have to spend a lot more time trying to analyse the statistics. And we've got to spend more time talking to people in China and to trying to understand exactly what the statistics are showing. But I think we've got to remember the level of development in these countries. When our level of GDP was theirs, our statistics weren't that great either. So I think we've got to be realistic about what can be achieved, but the ABS is in a good position to help, and I'm sure over time the quality of their statistics will improve.
I've got a question for Dr. Lowe. I'm Kai Chow from the Sky News Business Channel. Australia, of course, recently resolved its political situation, but some people are still a bit uncertain as to how certain policy situations will play out. How much does that type of policy or the uncertainty of having a minority government, do you think, impact on our current economic situation here in Australia?
I don't think it's particularly important. I mean, the investment that's taking place in the resources sector is really about is motivated by the long-term growth in Asia. And most of it has a horizon of decades. And the day-to-day movements in the political cycle are not particularly important in that investment. So the big picture story is, as I outlined, driven by growth in what's going on in the rest of the world and the strong fundamentals in Australia. Overlaid on that, there's continuing uncertainty about the strength of the global economy, and I think for some businesses that is an issue. But for those businesses focused on China, on India, on Asia, I think that's driven by the medium-term outlook, and as I talked about, that's pretty solid.
Hi there, Michael Dwyer from the Financial Review newspaper. I have a question for Dr. Lowe. You mentioned in your speech that the Australian economy currently had relatively limited amount of spare capacity. I'm just wondering what sort of statistics and indicators the central bank uses to come up with a conclusion like that. And secondly, what would be your assessment of the risk of the Australian economy overheating given this, you know, relatively limited amount of spare capacity?
Thank you. They're both very good questions. Measuring capacity is very difficult. The main measures we use are from the business surveys, and there are quite a number of those. The unemployment rate gives us another read on how much capacity there is, and based on the experience of the past decade, my judgment would be that we're almost at what would be considered full employment. We also spend quite a lot of time trying to understand developments in the capital stock, and as I showed you a graph there, the capital stock in Australia has been growing very quickly, and in principle that increases capacity in the economy, so that's something that we try and look at. So they're the main things. The probability of the economy overheating, well, 6 weeks ago we put out our updated forecasts, and there for the next year or so we've got the economy growing around its trend rate and inflation just being a little above the average or above the medium term target. I still think that's a pretty good set of forecasts, and so for the next year I think we'll be travelling along pretty much close to full capacity, but probably just a little bit under it.